Football on Off the Ball
with Sky. Don't miss Brentford versus Chelsea on Saturday Night Football, live on Sky Sports.
All right, I'm delighted to be joined on Off the Ball by one of the most recognisable faces and voices in English football. Kelly Cates is with us. How are you keeping, Kelly?
Very well, thank you. That's a nice introduction.
It must be a bit weird, is it? Being one of the most recognisable faces
on British TV. I'm not, because I'm a sort of background facilitator. That's my job.
When was the last time you walked into a pub and people didn't turn around and go, is that who I think it is?
No, I don't. But the thing is, I don't get that, because I think if people see me at football matches, then I make sense to them because I'm in that sort of environment. And then when I'm at football matches, I'm always with more interesting people. So I don't really get that, because when I'm out and about, people don't make the connection. So it's all good.
So you're not like, I think it was Gary Barlow who said he could go to the supermarket for the first time ever during COVID because you can wear masks and nobody recognizes them.
Yeah, I've not reached Gary Barlow levels.
I've done that terrible thing. I've done a lot of Googling of Kelly Cates. One of the main things I've learned, Kelly, you've never owned a football jersey. That's what Google tells me.
Well, I've never bought one, but I did get given one when Scotland played England in 1999, I think it would be. I had a Scotland shirt then, and it was I don't know if you remember, in the old days of Sky Sports News, they used to have a camera that went all the way from the back of the studio right over to the front, and you'd see the back of the presenter's sort of desk.
Okay.
You'd see the back of their heads. So I wore it for the very first shot at 7 o'clock in the morning. But I think at that stage it was an Adidas shirt and the show was sponsored by Nike. Oh. So we had like frantic phone calls going, tell her to get it off, take it off. So, yeah, I have one and I've still got it. But I've never bought one.
Because the assumption would be when you're a kid and you're around Liverpool and, you know, you see John Barnes or Ian Rush that you're going up saying, any chance of a jersey? Or was that not the done thing for the manager's daughter?
No. Well, at that stage, when I was at the age of being the manager's daughter, I was not encouraged to kind of hang around the footballers. In fact, quite the opposite. It was, you come into the office after I would have been young. I was like 13, 14, and then a little bit older. But it was, no, you come into the office, you come and stand with us and stay clear of everybody. But yeah, so it wasn't really a mingling opportunity.
Right. You obviously grew up with your father always being famous, so you were used to being around football. But would you have been, as a young child, starstruck by being in and around Liverpool dressing rooms, Blackburn dressing rooms, or was it just normal life?
It's different, because my first experience of footballers were as my mum and dad's friends. And it was as much I would see the wives and kids as I would the footballers. So, when it's your dad's workmates, they're not really that interesting. So that's kind of how I first saw footballers. And then footballers weren't what they are now. They weren't celebrities in the same way. They were footballers, just that was what they did. So there wasn't that same kind of glamour around them, I suppose. I mean, they'd probably be horrified to think they weren't glamorous, but yeah. Yeah. I remember going to something once. It was like a charity match and George Best was there, and kind of being a bit like, oh my God, that's George Best, because he was legendary.
George Best.
Yeah, exactly. And then, there's nobody really that I thought, and I did a little sort of couple of minute interview with David Beckham once, and I was a bit like, oh, it's David Beckham. But like, I just don't think about footballers in that way.
Yeah, it's probably a good thing in the job you're in as well. You don't want to be like Neville and Carragher have a bit of an ego.
Imagine if they came over
every day. Oh my God, amazing. I can't believe I'm working with you guys again.
Yeah, oh, they'd love it.
So what age are you then when you realise your dad is a little bit different to all the other dads?
Quite young. Because we were always kind of aware of it, but where we grew up, it wasn't a big deal because we were there all the time, and so people were just like sick of the sight of him. But I remember going to a Rod Stewart concert when I was a kid, and I think I was about nine, and it was at Ibrox, and we went there, and as we were walking around the inside of on the inside track bit to get round to our seats, people were stopping and asking my dad for, like, it was autographs. It wasn't pictures then. It was like for autographs. And my mum's like, that, oh, for Christ's sake, come on, come on. And she was just like dragging me, just bloody leave him, leave him to it. He'll catch up with us. So,
yeah,
that was the first time it ever really not affected my life, but that I ever really noticed it.
Yeah, it must be something now. And because the love is still there around Liverpool in particular and around Celtic as well, that now you can look at and go, wow, like this is, not everybody has this. That the warmth of an entire people towards one person that your dad brings out of generations of Liverpool supporters. It's a weird thing in lots of ways, but like it's such a special thing for him and I guess your family to have.
Yeah, and what's really lovely about it is we've had different generations of it. So he was there as player and manager, and then that was so much part of everyday life that you didn't really notice it then, because that was just how it was and how it had always been. But then particularly at Liverpool, when he went back the second time, there was just such a lovely warmth around it. And it was my mum said, you know, they'd go out for dinner and people who they'd known for years would suddenly come over and go, would you mind if we had a picture, or would you mind? And she's like, he's the same person he was last week. He's no more interesting than he was last week. And then, but the culture around football had changed. And then when he got the stand named after him and we went to the game and we went to the ground, and that was all really lovely. So you see, you get a different perspective on it from that way, that because when he was playing and then managing there, it was all just normal life. But to go back again has been really lovely. You see it differently.
Football has transformed even a field since Kenny left Liverpool the second time, and even the toxic side of it. And when he went back as manager the second time, I guess you were at a stage you were working around football, but also Twitter was around, you were online, you would see the comments if a result didn't go well. It was very different, I'd imagine, to when he was in charge first time around, where someone might say something on the street, but you wouldn't be reading it on your phone for 4 or 5 hours a day. How did you find it being a bit older and him going back as Liverpool manager, and probably you being far more aware of any criticism you would get than he was?
Yeah, and I was not comfortable at all with him going back, because you know what's coming, because it doesn't matter. Like, it's one of those things where look at Liverpool now, you look at what's happening with Jurgen Klopp, and there's still people online moaning, and you just think, right, well, you can't get away from it. So I just didn't look at it. I didn't look at the social media stuff. I just didn't pay any attention to it, because you just can't engage with it, because you're not engaging with rational people a lot of the time, you know. And it's not, I don't mean people who would go online and moan about a bad performance or a bad result. I mean, just some people are just, they're just fixated. There's a real kind of, I don't know, they just get stuck in this sort of negative spiral. And you see it with everything. It's the kind of, it's the sort of Messi and Ronaldo-fication of football, where everything has to be polar opposites. Everything has to be extreme. Somebody has to be the best. You can't just have a favorite. You've got to have the best. And it's all just a bit aggressive and pointless, I think.
And so much of it has become like that, and a lot of media coverage has become like that. When you're now presenting on Sky, is that to the forefront of your mind when you're presenting the coverage of, not getting balance, because maybe balance isn't always perfect either, but bringing an extra layer of depth to it, that it's not just, well, Cristiano Ronaldo's this or Cristiano Ronaldo's that. There's a level of analysis that I think Sky do so brilliantly with Neville and Carragher in particular. Is it something you have to spend a lot of time thinking about, that actually we don't want to be totally divisive here?
Yeah, I think particularly if it's one of those stories that everybody's had their say on, whatever it might be, you're kind of always looking for another way to come at it. Well, because I think say Brighton last season, the big story with Brighton was they have this huge XG and hardly any goals. Brighton can't score goals. That was the story. And it just felt, particularly because there were so many games that were live last season, and I seem to do a lot of Brighton ones, and we'd always talk about Yves Bissouma, and it would always be Brighton can't score goals and here's Yves Bissouma. And in some ways, that is the biggest story. That was the main talking point. But you're always trying to find slightly different ways to go at them. So, you know, you get people in with knowledge of Brighton, say, well, what are the options? Who can they use? How can they turn this around? Or, you know, is this just something that's going to naturally come to an end because, you know, the stats can't keep going on like this forever, whatever it might be. So you're constantly just trying to get a slightly fresher angle on what might be a story that's really done the rounds.
What's the process behind that? Obviously, I'd be nerdish about this and wanting to know, wanting to learn, but how much influence do you have on the talking points? How much influence do the pundits have, the producers behind the scenes? I assume it's a collaborative project, but would you go in quite often, quite passionate about things that you feel need to be discussed?
I think often the main stories are the obvious ones. And certainly, you know, I do a lot of the Fridays and Saturdays. So the Fridays are a bit more broad in terms of their scope. It's more of a magazine type build up. So there really isn't time for that sort of depth of analysis on a Friday. Saturdays, we've got half an hour and we're sort of straight into it. But often it's driven by the pundits. So, you know, it's because there's no point in me saying, unless the producer or I sort of think this is something we really want to get to the bottom of. But if you've got a pundit who goes, oh, I don't really think there's anything in that, there's not much point in asking them it on air because you're not going to get an interesting answer. And the whole point of it is to get interesting answers from them. So It might be that we have somebody in who has a special connection to Watford, for example, and they come in and say, no, you know, the ever-changing style of football at Watford. Well, what they're going to do now, because I know the manager, is X, Y, and Z, and this is how they're going to use the players, and these are the ones that are going to benefit. So a lot of it's driven by them because the whole point of it is to get their expertise. That's kind of the starting point for everything.
Yeah. One of the highlights already of this season, I think, was the first night of the season, and where Friday night football works so well, where you get the sense that everybody at Brentford might have had a drink or two before the game had started, and then they get this sensational result against Arsenal. And I guess that's why you're so good at your job, in that you just let it flow, that actually you just stand back and say, this is a bit crazy. This is not in the script. The manager's coming over. There's people in the stands, Carragher and Neville in the stands, and you just got to run with it, enjoy it.
But it's exactly like you said, the story there. I mean, we did reflect on Arsenal's performance and Arsenal's defending in particular, and that, but it wasn't the story. You know, the story was football's back. We've got fans in, we've got a promoted side beating Arsenal. It was, and what was nice about that is it had all been set up from the beginning, because the Brentford fans were really confident, because in a way they had the best possible start, because you have a team with as big a name as Arsenal but who were as beatable as Arsenal. So you kind of get the best of both worlds there. And it was just so lovely. I mean, there was a part of me walking into the ground that was, as it started to get full, that was getting quite anxious about seeing everybody really close together, and then they start singing Hey Jude, and it was just really lovely after, you know, that whole season where we barely saw a supporter inside the grounds, and it felt so sterile, and we got used to it because you do, and then it came back in the best way, and you just think this is the whole point of it. You know, as much as we want to sit and get all the analysis right, and we try to do that and try to get the stories right, sometimes it's just about the emotion of it, and you can't ever forget that, I think.
Mm. Did you always want to work in football?
Nope. No. I, not until about, I don't know, a couple of months before I left uni, I was doing a maths degree, and I was sort of thinking about jobs in that area, not with much enthusiasm. And Sky Sports News was starting up. So I was like, well, I could go and speak to them and see how it is. And at that stage, they just screen tested everybody. And at the time, I thought, God, they've seen something in me. You know, they want to put me on screen. But really what they were doing was using my dad's name to publicize this brand new channel. But, you know, at 22, I was starry eyed and thought this was my moment. So I just, but where I was really lucky with that was that, well, lucky again with that, was that Sky Sports News wasn't available for anybody to watch. It literally went out around the building for the first few months. And so we just got thousands and thousands of hours under our belts of live TV, and live TV working with a load of kids basically in their early 20s who were practicing, who were getting all their practical experience together. And so we'd all make mistakes. And so you learned to cover up or move on or gloss over things. And it was just, looking back on it, it was such a brilliant learning experience. And it was just really, really good fun.
So were you able to move on quite quickly then from maybe the family name has got me in here to actually I belong here for myself?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I don't know. I don't think you can ever kind of leave it behind completely, because it's a fact. You know, it's how it worked. But then all you can do with the opportunity is sort of take it and work hard with it. And yeah. Then I think by the time I left Sky Sports, because I was there for nearly 9 years. So by the time I left, I was sort of relatively confident that I could do the job 9 years in.
Yeah, just took the 9 years. Like, the hard work is the key, I guess, because you can't fake that side of it. And we had Gary Neville on the show a couple of years ago, and he was talking about becoming a pundit. And yeah. I think he was with Roy Keane, and Keane was sort of saying at that stage, he wasn't fully committed. He wasn't fully committed at that stage. And Roy obviously changed his mind. I think about 2 weeks later, he signed his contract with Sky, where he decided to go full time. But Gary Neville was making the point: you can't turn up for Liverpool, Manchester United, and 3 months later do Manchester United, Manchester City. Like, this is every week. You've got to be absolutely committed. And by the sounds of it, that's what you were. That even though you had the name, you weren't really looking to take any shortcuts here. You knew that this is weekends, unsociable hours, all of that, and you just got on with the gig.
Oh yeah, but then my whole life had been weekends and unsociable hours, because that was my dad's job. So I was used to, you know, him maybe not being there for a lot of Christmas Day or things like that. So when I had to work Christmas, it was like, oh, it's not ideal. But you know, there's people, because I was younger at the time as well, there were people with kids. So I was like, well, it's more important that they have Christmas with their families, and that you know, this is what you do when you're young and you're starting out, or like 4 a.m. starts or whatever they were, and that kind of thing. You do it, you put the hours in. And the thing with football is that the best hours are not the most sociable hours. The most interesting times to work are antisocial hours. It's weekends and Christmas and night times and early mornings, whenever it is, but they're the best times to work. So you get it back.
At times it's becoming farcical, and you have to really feel for these players and management. This isn't normal in any shape or form.
For your first chance to hear Brian O'Driscoll on OTB, download the OTB Sports app and turn on your notifications.
Yeah. Like, from the outside, obviously, your childhood sounds like the greatest childhood of all time. You're growing up in Kenny Dalglish's house. But as you say, he is in a job, firstly as a player, then as a player manager, and as a manager at one of the biggest clubs in world football. And he's not always there. That was just something, I guess, you're always used to, that actually he's got two priorities here.
Yeah, somebody was asking me about this the other day, and I was like, I don't remember him being away a lot, but he clearly was away a lot. But then I don't really remember him being there either. It's just kind of like background noise. I don't know. I suppose it would take years of therapy to kind of try and unpick it. But I think it was just, it was accepted. I think kids are so adaptable that you give them a set of circumstances and you go, here's your life. Mum was at home all the time. Dad was away and home and away and home. But then in other ways, you know, he'd finish training in the early afternoon and come home. So he'd be there when we got back from school in the week. So, you know, he wasn't working Monday to Friday long hours, but he was working weekends and holidays. So, yeah, it was just a sort of fact of life, I suppose.
Yeah, I'd say pre-Hillsborough and everything that followed, was he affected by the results? Would everyone in the house know on a Saturday? Now, in fairness, results were generally pretty good.
But he would more be, and certainly as a manager, he was more affected by performances than results. So they could win and you'd be coming home in the car and you'd be in a foul mood, and all the way home you'd be like that, oh God. But, and it's like, Chris, this is what he's like when they've won. And we'd all be sitting moaning in the back seat. And, it was performances, because I think that's the thing he could control. Results you can't really control, but the performances you can. So that's what would wind him up if there was a bad performance.
You did a brilliant documentary for the BBC on Hillsborough, where I think you spoke a little bit about your own experience, but mostly with the families and with your dad. And for anyone who hasn't heard it, I think you can get it on the BBC app. But, you know, it finishes, I think you say, thanks, Dad. And it's in that manner of, you know, he's opened up maybe in a way he hadn't previously. That, because you were at Hillsborough with your brother as well. Like, that day, is that the day in your life that stands out above all others that changed everything for your family?
I mean, yeah, you could definitely say that. I'm not sure if it stands out or if it stands, it sort of stands alone. I think it's kind of, I think it changed everything for a lot of people, I think. And, you know, I always worry talking about it that, you know, because my experience of it was nothing compared to the experience of people who lost family members, of people who were there, of people who still live with the effects of it, and people who've died as a result of Hillsborough later in their lives. And you know, it turned people's lives completely upside down, and people are still fighting for that now. Still now. It was 1989 and they're still fighting. And I find that extraordinary, and it still makes me really, really angry that nobody properly has been held to account for it. I think there is the issue of somebody being made to take responsibility for Hillsborough itself, but I think it also has huge repercussions for crowd safety in any situation. If there are no repercussions, if nobody is held accountable for this, then it feels more likely that it will happen again, even though there have been safety improvements in the grounds as a result of Hillsborough.
It does feel as though over the last few years that every time there's been a step forward, and there've been some big steps forward towards justice, it's just taken away again. And for the families, every time, I would imagine, it's brought up, they're reminded, and the stress and the strain of that, like, it is just this huge burden on the city that anytime you go to Liverpool, you go around Anfield, you can almost still feel it. Your dad was on the show with us last year, and you know, he gave a similar answer, and I think it's his always been his way of, yes, I suffered, but again, compared to the families of the 97 victims, we haven't really. But even still, for you, if you're, what are you, your teenage years, these are pretty formative years. There's firstly the impact of you're at the ground, but also you're having to watch as your dad, and I guess your mom as well, are going through this just most terrible of experience that nothing can prepare you for, that nobody can take you aside and say, here's how you deal with something like this. That's a lot to go through as a teenager.
Yeah, and it was everywhere. You know, I know you're saying that if you go to Liverpool now, or you're around Anfield now, there is always a presence. And at the time, you know, it was assemblies in school about it. Then it was in the papers. It was on the news. Mum and dad were at funerals pretty much every day. I think they went to over half of the funerals, which would have been, would have been 95 at the time, I think. So that was them for a couple of weeks. If they weren't at the funerals, then they were in at Anfield and talking to families, talking to people who just wanted to come to the ground. So it was all consuming, not just that day, but all around that time. But that's not to say that was a bad thing. I think sometimes when you're part of something, even if it's at a slight distance, if you're part of something that feels that huge, there's something quite comforting in being around other people to whom it is maybe even more important. Mm. And that was helpful, I think, for mum and dad, I think, to be in and around the ground like that. Paul and I went in one day. We weren't there. We were 12 and 13. And we went in, and Paul tied a teddy bear on the goal at the Kop end, and we walked along the Kop and we saw all the tributes. So but the atmosphere it felt, it was incredibly moving, and also it just, it felt right. I think it felt like the right thing to do.
Your dad is a reluctant hero at the best of times, I think, but when he talks about Hillsborough, say, he sort of moves it to one side. But like, of all the things he has achieved, I'd imagine as a family, the pride with how he handled that, and how you as a family handled that, because I'm sure your mom was a huge part of that as well, in supporting you as kids and supporting him as a husband, that you got through that as a family, and also the leadership that the entire family showed throughout the years.
Yeah, I think my mum's role in all of it was, as you say, was huge as well, because like you said, she's kind of managing her family, two of whom were there on the day, and then two little ones as well. My sister would have been a baby at the time, my younger sister, and at the same time sort of supporting my dad. And, you know, as most men of that generation and upbringing are, not a talker about his feelings, or, you know, not somebody who's gonna give very much away about it. So yeah, I think her, what she did was incredible. And I think there was I think that, you know, we didn't talk about it a lot at the time, but I think from what we've talked about since, and from what Dad has said since, I think there was, I think that because he understood it, because he understood the club, because he understood the fans, because he understood the families, that I think he was able to say and do the right things that were what people needed at the time, because he knew them. They were, you know, there was a connection there, and that's why they knew what to do, I think.
Yeah. I can't imagine in terms of his footballing career there's any regrets. It's interesting listening to Alex Ferguson since his retirement, and I won't say he wishes he'd retired earlier, but probably it funnily came around to what he had missed because of his utter commitment to Manchester United. Did you get the sense ever from your dad that there was a bit of, geez, I did miss all those Christmas days?
No, not that, but oh my god, like with his grandchildren, it's as though they're miracles, because he never saw his own kids reach a lot of the milestones. So he's suddenly just like, oh my God, that's really early for them to be talking, isn't it? That's like, oh my, can you believe they're doing that already? Look at the way he kicks that ball. I mean, he's only small. And you're like, you know, we did all that. We all learned to do all that. It's like, but also it wasn't even just that he wasn't there. That was because he was like a dad in the late 70s, yeah, early 80s. It was like, that wasn't his remit.
Yeah, that's fair enough. Were you, when he went back, which we touched on already, but were you concerned in any way when he went back to Liverpool?
Yeah, because I think when somebody's seen in the way that he was seen at Liverpool before he went back, it feels like there's only one way it can go. But I think he felt like he could help. And I think what he did, although, you know, he'll say it himself about like the league position, but just getting to Wembley and winning a trophy, I mean, as hard fought as it was against Cardiff, but he got to go and do that. My daughter was three, and she got to go to Wembley and see her grandpa win a trophy. And, yeah, you know, I've got a great picture of it with the medal. She's kind of playing with his medal around his neck. And it was just, you know, so that I think, and that's not just our family. There were kids who hadn't been to Wembley in years who were there. So I think he feels that, even though that probably wouldn't rank outside as one of his biggest achievements, I think it felt like a sea change. I think the club needed that at the time. It needed to be kind of, I don't know, brought back to what it was. And then I think that kind of, that helped to turn the tide a little bit for what came next.
The emotional, and listen, maybe you've been at Brentford, which is a brand new stadium, you can see what football can do to people. I was going to say, do you get a sense that the emotional side of the game is almost more important to Liverpool than it is, and Liverpool supporters in the majority? Or is that just bias?
I'm not sure about the supporters, because I think all supporters have that. I think that very, very, very broadly speaking, I think Liverpool's a very sentimental city. I think the sort of Irish influence in Liverpool is really clear. I think you see it as Celtic as well. That it is about the songs and the history. I mean, look, I know I'm talking about lots of clubs and people get really annoyed because they're like, Christ, they're talking about it like it's special or it's different. But there, Celtic has it, and there are a couple of other clubs as well. But there is something about that kind of unashamed emotion and that unashamed sentiment that I think is unusual, definitely. I don't think it's unique to Liverpool. Like I said, I think Celtic has it as well, but it's unusual, definitely.
So these talented grandkids, are they going to play for Scotland or England?
Well, if it's mine won't represent anyone in sports. they're lovely kids, but I don't think that's where their future lies. I would push mine into Scotland, but they'll play for whoever picks them, wouldn't they?
Yeah. You know how these things work. We got to get the views on this. So Kelly, rank us 1 to 4, Roy Keane, Micah Richards, Gary Neville, Jamie Carragher, in terms of your favourite pundits.
No, I can't. And the reason I can't is because I think that they would care, and they don't care because it's what I think of them. They care because they never lose that competition. They never lose that competitive spirit. And genuinely, whatever it is, they all want to come out on top of each other in. So, so I can't, I just can't. I think I'd have to maybe go, through in terms of who I thought it would matter most to. And I mean, again, that's
who would matter most to?
Well, that's what I don't know. It'd matter most to them in different. Roy, because he just wants to win. Gary because he likes to think he's the best. Cara would pretend not to care, but maybe would. And Mike is quite sensitive, so I think it would hurt Micah's feelings if he wasn't at the top. So that's why I couldn't rank them.
I'd imagine, and you definitely get the sense, are loving the Roy Micah bromance as much as the Jamie Gary bromance.
It's just, there's such a lovely balance to it. I think when it works really, really well, they bring out the best in each other. So there's Micah gives a real warmth to Roy, and I think Roy gives Micah a little bit of steel in the argument. And I think that's a really lovely thing to have when you have them kind of balancing each other out, because it each one makes the other one better, I think. But the bromance, my God, who'd have picked Micah and Roy?
Wow. Who was that producer? Who was that guy? Deserves a raise.
I know. Although, to be honest, I think that almost could be just Micah going in one day and going, nah, I'm not having this. Come on, Roy. Come on. Because Roy, like, you've worked with him. Like, Roy on air is not the same as Roy off air.
No.
You know, I suppose actually when he did your show, he actually was.
Well, there was a couple of moments. Yeah, off air, he couldn't have been nicer.
Yeah. But it's a very different, and so sometimes you kind of, I know writer Ian Wright says that sometimes, that he comes on air giggling when he's working with him because he's funny off air. And then he sees the countdown clock going and he goes, puts a serious face on. So he kind of, so he's usually chuckling at Roy as well.
What's next then, Kelly? What's the ambition?
Oh, I don't know.
It's a dangerous thing in media, isn't it? Talking about your ambitions.
I'm quite happy with what I'm doing at the moment. You know, sort of Premier League football, bit of radio, which lets me cover the EFL and the Champions League. And, then I can wander off and do World Cups and Euros and things. So I'm nervous to wish for any more because I quite like things as they are.
Well, that's a good place to be in life, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so.